Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. Have accessed entry 1203.PS7716, certificate number 16230, the spirit of Australia.
They told me it's about 50-50 as far as the record goes.
But isn't this, for a man with a wife and family, isn't this some sort of madness to chance your life in a 50-50 way?
I don't think so. I think I'm going to be one of the lucky 50, not the unlucky 50.
What would you say the spirit of Australia even is?
Shrimp on Barbie.
I'm going to say Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah, well, that's a knife.
The spirit of Australia is
that's a knife.
Is thinking that big American knives are small. That's the main thing.
Yeah. What is the spirit of Australia? It sounds like some kind of dirigible.
It is going to be, indeed, some kind of craft.
But yeah, the rest of the spirit of Australia.
Have you ever been to the? Have you been to Australia?
I wish.
Have you been to the Southern Hemisphere?
Yes, I've been to Chile and Argentina and Uruguay.
Did I ever tell you about when I walked across South America, Ken?
But Australia is one of those places, as a pop musician, like Japan, that there's enough of an audience, a market for American rock and roll. That
in theory,
a lot of my friends' bands have toured Japan and they've toured Australia.
Our friend Jason Finn was texting me when I was in Australia to be like, love it there. Oh, like you got to do this. You got to go to a Wallabies game. And I was like, did you used to live here? No, we just really hit it big here. I was like, were you called the prime ministers here? And he was like, yeah.
I'm sure he liked that.
He loved that joke.
In the Presidents of the United States of America community, by which I mean the 3/4 people that are actually in the band, there's this kind of this apocryphal story about having been offered a tour where they were going to get $1 million a show.
What?
And one of the people, yeah, I know. One of the guys in the band is convinced that they were going to get $1 million a show, but they had to turn it down for some reason that no one is quite clear on. One of the people is like, there was never $1 million a show offer. That's a complete fabrication. One of the guys has a different version of the story. And so this, when you talk about Australia with any individual member of the Presidents of the USA, you'll get a different version of this. Like, oh, there was this one tour.
I love this idea of a Spinal Tap or a Get Back or a Beatles anthology where there's some festering thing with the band, but no one's sure what it is. No, didn't you leave the studio first? No, I wasn't even in town that day.
I'm pretty sure of everyone in the world that knows the story of the aborted like President's Tour of Australia. I may have more information than anybody, but just from having heard it from
you could finally write the long form journalism.
That's
of
what
this.
Everybody wants.
Maybe this should be the last. Maybe the last omnibus we do together should be finally getting to the bottom of why, whether or not the Presidents of the United States of America could indeed have got $1 million a show.
No, someone pitched me a podcast this morning where they were like, "Hey, what if you just interviewed old indie rockers?" And I was like, yeah, for an audience of 250 indie rockers.
There were enough people to pay them $1 million in a country with the population of Florida. So
the Long Winters never went to Japan because as far as I could discern, there was zero interest from Japan.
The only thing keeping you from going to Japan was a grand total of zero listeners.
Yeah. The Japanese music market is kind of like the UK, except even more like hard to understand. Some bands are just huge.
Yeah.
And some American bands that are completely obscure, just everybody in Japan just decides. And then other bands, they don't care. And the Long Winters were that. Australia, though, the Long Winters do great there. I have a lot of fans. We're on the radio down there.
Are you called the Long Summers? Hey, see, you're laughing.
Jason, you're cranking them out.
Jason Finn was not a fan of this ilk of joke.
I don't know if I could say I'm a fan of it.
No, no, you loved it, right?
That was fun.
Solid 10.
You actually, when you were down there, didn't you do some "the toilet is flushing the wrong direction" content?
Well, I was so delighted. The first day, the morning we get there, I just got back from a couple of weeks there. Mindy and I had our 25th anniversary, and I actually had a couple of weeks off work through a weird twist of fate.
You looked like you were having fun.
We had a really good time. You went everywhere, huh? But the first day we walk into our hotel, and the revolving doors are literally going the other direction. And I was like, who knew the Coriolis effect? It's actually correlated with which side of the road people drive on.
No, it is not.
It is, because think about it. If you're driving on the left, you also are walking in sidewalks on the left, which means going through a door, you would pass through on the left and people coming out would be on your right.
I see.
And that means the door has to go clockwise.
Which came first? Whereas here, is the chicken and which is the egg?
The revolving door was invented first.
Okay.
In the dream time.
Okay. But this like sidism.
Didn't we do a whole show on this?
I think we must have.
We did.
It's been 8 years.
It was about what Sweden switching sides.
That's right.
Yeah, it had something to do with horse carriages and whether the driver of the horse would be on the curb side or on the side of the approaching horse. I can't remember.
The side of the approaching horse.
It was all about holding the reins in your dominant hand.
That's
or,
what it was.
Or high-fiving the French peasants lining up alongside the road or stealing their pitchforks. Anyway, so this whole trip, I'm thinking, Australia's kind of far away.
It's a
lot of people
way.
Don't know that.
No, it takes forever to get there.
Even though we were in LA, I was taping, so we had a nonstop, which was nice. It's still like 15 hours.
15 hours.
You get on the plane in the middle of the night, you go to bed, you get on the plane at like midnight, you go to sleep, you wake up after a full night's sleep, if you're lucky, and there's still like 7 or 8 hours to go. You're like not even to Fiji yet.
But for someone like you who wants to watch 8 movies in a row, it seems like being forced into a posture where it's like, Ken, all you can do is watch another movie.
Let me tell you, I never thought I would watch all 5 hours of the Billy Joel documentary on HBO. God. And guess what?
What a slog.
I watched half of it on the way out and half of it on the way back.
I made it. Oh, 3/4 of the way through that. And then
you only see him get ripped off by his manager twice. It probably happened 3 more times. You don't know.
The place I punched out was when Christy Brinkley was like, all I wanted was for this marriage to work. And then it cuts to him like, I don't know, man. Yeah. Sometimes you just got to.
It's so
chicks,
funny.
Am I right?
Because everybody else around him is like, he was drinking a lot. And when they go to Billy, he's like, I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Weird.
Sometimes a woman just. And I was like, I can't.
I think I've gotten to the bottom of this.
It was funny because I the whole time I'm like, look, I've always been kind of a Billy Joel denier. And I know that that's not supportable. His music is undeniable. There's like
one of our great songwriters.
Great songs. Great. I've seen him live and it's an incredible show. A great rock show. One of the top rock shows. But I just, I was never on Team Joel. And I said, this is going to be one of those where you watch the documentary and you're like, now I get it. And I'm converted. 3/4 of the way through.
Turned you away.
I said, no,
you've
I
become
actually,
a Billy Joel atheist.
I wrote a little letter to myself. I was like, dear John, it's okay to not like Billy Joel. You don't have to feel bad. It's just how it is.
I like him less now. I actually enjoyed it. But the point of Australia being so far away is I started to wonder, how could this country be worth it?
Oh.
It's like, do I really want to go to the mall all the way across town because they have a few different stores?
I see what you're saying.
You know? Like there's 3 malls closer to me, and yes, one of them doesn't have a Hot Topic, but or whatever, you know, one of them doesn't have an Apple store. But are the different stores really going to be like? Am I going to go to Uluru and think, oh yeah, like Grand Canyon and Sedona are better? Or am I going to go to the Queensland coast and be like, you know what? Maui is a lot closer,
pretty nice.
And if I go to Sydney and it just reminds me of Vancouver, that's going to be a bummer.
You were thinking that Australia...
I thought it might under-deliver.
It might just be like a United States, but
yeah,
kind of
but lower.
On half speed.
Exactly. What if it's like Billy Joel? What if I think I like Australia and then I spend 2 weeks in the outback and I don't...
As an Alaskan, as I travel, I don't know if I've ever told you about my extensive travels.
I'm writing this down.
To other places that weren't Australia. But you meet other travelers when you're a young person sleeping in youth hostels and park benches.
Yeah.
And when I would meet Australian youths, they resembled Alaskans.
Ah, so the spirit of Australia, whatever it is, must be the spirit of Alaska.
Similar enough to where we would see each other in bars, you know, where you kind of see a like-minded person just in the way they're behaving and the way they hold themselves. A lot of kind of jocular confidence, a lot of willingness to risk their physical safety for a laugh, you know, like a tendency to kind of throw yourself through a plate glass window if maybe it's not even required for the joke to land. Like just a kind of...
Does Australia have plate glass windows now?
I think
just
they
got
arrived
their first one?
Recently from overseas.
How about Alaska? Someday they're going to get one.
No, it's still just bricks of ice. But yeah, so I was often making common cause in like street brawls and big, you know, guitar tosses and whatever. Like I would find myself surrounded by or on the side of Australians enough times that it felt not like an American Australian thing, but specifically Alaskans.
Alaska is the Australia of America.
I actually used to say that. Alaska is kind of the Australia of North America. And when I would make jokes about Alaska online, Australians would often be the ones who are like, ah, ha, ha, I get it. So anyway, I do feel, having never been there, I feel like...
A deep kinship.
I would get it, right? I would land and I would understand the spirit of Australia.
I think we should like lay in some didgeridoo music every time you talk about the spirit of
Australia.
Not Koyaanisquatsi. That's not Australian. Anyway, I don't want to leave Australians in suspense because what happened is I got there and I found out it was just a wonderland, like
a wonderland
on every level. We were just so delighted. Like Sydney is the most impossibly gorgeous and livable city. I was like, okay, it's going to be Toronto, but I'm flying 16 hours to get here. What is the point of this? No, it looks like the city in a Pixar movie or something. It's it's set in this like made up thing with all these amazing natural harbors. And they've kept all this parkland like in and adjacent to the city. There's ferries crisscrossing all the time and all the gorgeous architecture. The food was really good. Like everything about it seemed great. People seemed like they had a really good like work-life balance. Locals are chatty. Just a great bustling but like kind of perfect city. And then we loved everything else we saw too. We were, I had a friend who had moved there. Like in his possibly revisionist retelling, he started investigating Australia the day Trump came down the escalator at Trump Tower.
That's a little convenient.
Presumably he means the time Trump announced his presidential run, not just some random time Trump was coming into the lobby.
He just closed what he was looking at on his laptop and opened, how do I move to Australia?
He Googled Australian consulate. But, you know, as it turned out, I can't make too much fun of his revisionism because now he's an Australian permanent resident and we're stuck here.
Australian permanent resident? Well, I guess that was 8 years. That was more than eight years ago.
Yeah, it's almost a decade. And it took him a while. He's been living there. He lived there throughout COVID and has lived in many different Australian states. And he just, like, he had so much evangelical zeal about Australia that, first of all, it didn't seem like he was describing a real place.
Right.
It seemed like he was... And but also it seemed like maybe he was protesting too much.
Sure.
You know, like, boy, I sure don't regret this move across the world where I don't know anyone.
Now I have to eat Vegemite and pretend that I like it.
It really was just like, you know, yeah, talking up Vegemite and just every aspect of, I just want to talk about the Australian National Health System at you for a couple hours. And
hey, Ken, have you ever had a really big bug crawl in your nose while you're sleeping and then another bug crawls in to kill it?
This is a funny thing about Australia because you and I remember a time when people would go there just for the wildlife.
Yeah.
You know, kids would just be fascinated by, look at this, there's wallabies and there's platypi and I got to go. And today, everybody under 30 is like, well, I can't go to Australia. Have you seen the spiders? They're the size of dinner plates. Like the snakes have enough venom that if they look at you, you die.
And, yeah, and from then across the room.
Your spouse dies also somehow.
Well, not to confirm the kind of quirky Wes Andersonness of Australia, but I have a friend who is a nurse of veterinary medicine in Australia. Who
an American expatriate?
No, she's Australian, and she followed your trip across Australia with a lot of avidity, and I think was trying to, you know, send you like social network, sort of like, hi, oh my God, you're here.
Those things I don't open.
Yeah. But was then messaging me like, Ken's like here and I don't want to be weird, but, and I'm like, no, there's really nothing. I can't like get you into his hotel. She works in a Australian veterinary capacity, but not like people's cats. It's like a rescue hospital for wallabies and woolabies and boobadoos.
Wallaroos and kangaroos and kangabees.
Yeah,
and
klingabombs.
Koalabies.
And so every single day she's like sending me a picture of some animal wrapped in a towel that looks like a not possible animal. Yeah. It's like, well, that seems like it's a combination of a monkey, a rat, and a butterfly, but why does it have 14 legs? And she's like, isn't it cute? And they all seem like kind of murder capable, but like also like soft and friendly.
It turns out the universe wants every biome to have like a deer, a monkey, you know, but when Australia didn't have all these things, nature was just like, I guess we just have to turn a marsupial into a deer and we'll turn another marsupial into a duck. And we'll turn a marsupial into a monkey. And we'll, you know, so you have koalas, you know, they're just like nature trying to make a monkey.
Yeah.
And it can't.
Right.
And
right.
I did have the experience of seeing a cuddly koala and being like, oh, and then it kind of gets up and arches its back to walk across a branch and it turns into the Babadook. And you're like, wait, no. Go back to sleep.
And this is the thing, my friend, her apartment, there's always like some parrot that's yelling at you.
Oh, so many parrots.
But the parrot is also yelling at the snake. You know, like the house is just feels like a Dr. Doolittle kind of situation, but every animal is, yeah, both vaguely predatory and also like so cute you can't resist it. Even the bugs, you kind of want to... Like, look at this spider. It's the size of a cat.
We were looking for spiders the whole time because our kids would never come to Australia because they're like, no, the internet told me.
Spiders.
Snakes and spiders. We're going to die.
You never saw a spider.
We were frantically looking for. Every time we saw a spider web, we were like, this is it. We finally saw a huntsman on a tree and it was like kind of a small one.
You know where you can see spiders?
The Great Northwest.
Right outside the door there where there are 1 billion spiders waiting.
Mindy came home from Australia. It's October in Seattle. Three giant house spiders. I mean, that's their name, the giant house spider. They are, you know, the size of your hand, and yeah, they're just like chilling on our shower curtain.
As the dad of a teenage girl and with her mother, my sister, both being arachnophobes, this is the time of year when I have the most to do right, of any time of year.
Any time of day or night.
I'm just walking around with a peanut butter jar like, I got it. It's okay. I'm talking to him like, it's okay, buddy. Come on. We're going outside.
The reason why I mentioned my expat friend is because he sent an extremely detailed travelogue of what I should do in Sydney. And then when he found out we were going to go up to the Blue Mountains for one day, he said, great, I spent COVID up there. Here's another six-page summary of things to
this
do.
This guy's driving me crazy.
No, it was great.
Oh.
I mean, you don't have to read it if you don't want to, but like, I was like, oh, this might be good intel. And it really was. He was like, now it's really hard to get off the highway there to the left, so you want to do this on the way back.
Oh, okay.
But the light's better at this waterfall in the late afternoon. So I would do this at the end of the day. I was like, this guy's like ChatGPT. Like,
news you can use.
I know. It was pretty good. And he was just kind of talking, you know, walk around Sydney. He's right. It's just a gorgeous downtown center.
What's the architecture like?
It all looks like the Sydney Opera House.
No.
every skyscraper looks like a conquistador helmet from one side and a pistachio shell from the other. No.
I mean, does it look like a British colonial tropical city,
you know, what's
at the
funny?
Low
Is it,
level?
No, it doesn't have that kind of Kenyan-looking railing where you think, you know, Claire Foy as the queen will be leaning over. I thought it would be
shutters
more
and
Bermuda
slow moving fans.
I can't explain this, and maybe Australians should explain this to me. It looks like New Orleans.
Oh,
wrought iron balconies. I was surprised. But like, there's a lot of old timey, a lot of Sydney dates back. I mean, there's still stuff left from when they first like put the convicts on the Rock. You know, there's this old neighborhood of,
is there
the Rocks in on the water in Sydney, and so we like toured some of these old
their Plymouth
tenements.
Rock is like get off the boat and get working.
It is their Plymouth, like imagine if, because their Plymouth Rock is also their New York City. It's their biggest city. It's where the boat landed, and it's you know, cultural center. It's everything. And it's in their
city?
Most gorgeous spot. So it's like, what if Monterey and New York City and Plymouth Rock were all one spot for your country? And it's just, so it's got this cool old kind of Chicago-y downtown with these great, cool brick skyscrapers that are clearly over a century old, but also new glass spire high rises.
What do they make in Australia? Is it like sugar cane? Do they make like whips? I'm not sure. What the hell is their industry?
It's all opals and mutton all the way down.
Opals and mutton. Yeah, that checks out.
There's a lot of mining, I think.
Oh, resource extraction. Again, like Alaska.
Should we meet the mining adjacent guy at the start of this story? Have we just talked about nothing for long enough? Remember, John and I had a dream that these episodes would be short because we have to do four shows today, which we have not done in, I don't even know, years?
Been a couple of years. Well, ever since we stopped being twice a week, which was the craziest thing. I'll never stop marveling.
And we were just like, yeah.
Oh, I guess.
I guess we didn't have jobs and there was a pandemic for a lot of it.
But 2-hour-long shows a week for
plus.
Years.
Yeah.
No wonder we never get to the topic.
No.
Can you imagine?
No wonder we never like hang out except for Omnibus because we've talked about everything at least once. We're on the record as loving Mint Mobile.
Yep.
Who have supported the show for many months now.
They have.
But I feel like we haven't persuaded all of our listeners. Some of them, John, are still, and this makes me furious, by the way.
Yes.
They are overpaying for wireless.
Yeah, they like their legacy wireless companies because they are averse to change, or they somehow think that old wireless is more stable.
They've been listening to two middle-aged men on Omnibus for 8 years. They're not just going to switch their wireless, but boy, they should.
Yeah, they should.
Right?
They should.
At Mint Mobile, their favorite word is no. It's time to say yes to saying no.
What are we saying no to?
No contracts.
No contracts?
No monthly bills. Can your carrier compete with that? No hidden fees.
No hidden fees.
No BS. Here's why we said yes to making the switch. Our premium wireless, John, is $15 a month.
That's insane.
You can ditch your overpriced wireless monthly bill. Sometimes you get unexpected overages. Do you ever get one of those? You get back from a trip and your kid didn't have roaming turned off and suddenly you owe 70 bucks.
Here's what I learned about legacy media and telecom companies. They don't care about you.
They don't.
No.
They love hidden fees. It's their favorite thing.
It's their number one.
They're like, hey, let's hide some fees. They're like a squirrel with an acorn. I just want to hide some fees.
Where are we going to put these fees?
On Mint Mobile, plans start at $15 a month. All their plans have high-speed data and unlimited talk and text. They have the nation's largest 5G network, and you can keep your own phone and your phone number. If that's why you're change-averse, don't worry. Same phone number. You're still going to have amazing service. Your contacts will still be there. You will just be paying as little as $15 a month.
It's a game changer.
They sent me a little virtual SIM so I could try it out, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, I didn't notice any change at all from my previous carrier.
The fact that it's a digital SIM is amazing.
Their quality is amazing. Are you ready to say, this is the weird theme of this, are you ready to say yes to saying no?
I'm ready.
To me, that seems needlessly convoluted, but I did not write this, John.
Okay. Let's say yes to say no.
I think Ryan Reynolds wrote this. Here's how you make the switch if we've talked you into this. Go to mintmobile.com /omnibus. Can you say that, John?
Mintmobile.com/omnibus. Super easy.
Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 a month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gig on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
That's mintmobile.com/omnibus.
It's autumn, John. That means cold and flu season is here.
I know it well.
Wouldn't it be? During COVID, I never got sick because everybody was staying away and wearing masks. And I get sick less than my kids are no longer in grade school.
Right.
But
they stopped licking doorknobs.
I still hate just random illness sneaking up on me.
Do you know
winter.
What's crazy? The other day I was in my forest. I was planting some trees. And
I don't have a trophy here for you, but please
you.
Go on.
Thank you. And my sister and daughter sat on a log. And the log broke and fell down the slope.
This story has everything.
And I sprang into action because I was afraid my sister and daughter were going to get crushed by a log. And I jumped over and stopped the rolling log and immediately was covered with mold spores that had been living in the log and was choking and coughing.
This is a Star Trek episode.
Yeah. My daughter and sister escaped with no spores, but I was like, quack, 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 quack. And then the spores created in me a vulnerability to sickness and allergy. And then for several days, I was, before the spores get to my mind and turn me into an automaton zombie.
Last of Us zombie.
I, at least right now, am struggling with a lot of vulnerability to sickness.
I hate getting sick in the winter. Let's suggest a way we can winter-proof our listeners' bodies. That's a service we provide at Omnibus. We winter-proof everyone's body.
Well, no,
but only with their autonomy and consent.
We know that we aren't promising any sort of medical connection between us and our listeners. But what are we able to do?
We are not licensed to be your doctors, but a lot of wellness preparation starts inside your body, like before you get that fever, before you get that cough. I want you to investigate, as John and I have, Function Health. It's the only health platform that gives us data people never get. It's information about you, over 100 biomarkers inside Function. You learn about your hormones, toxins, different markers of heart health, inflammation, stress. They even have MRI and chest CT scans for an additional fee, and this is all tracked in one online platform over time. So it's just a way to keep on top of everything about your health in a way that, maybe even your checkup wouldn't do.
I hate filling out forms. I'm well known for this. And yet I really enjoyed inputting all of this information about my health into Function because I had never had it all in one place. All of this health information and data just kind of swirling around. I've never been able to compare and contrast it. And so putting it all into Function and having this this ability to calculate it and interrelate it was kind of exciting.
Not just like patient autonomy and rights. You also get access to a lot of stuff that would not ever be included in your yearly physical. Do you want to know your vitamin D levels, your zinc levels, your white blood cell count? Like that's something that your GP may not do. And if you're wondering why I keep getting sick, this is the kind of stuff Function Health can help with, recover faster, figure out why you're tired this time of year. This could be the key to a lot better health for you this fall and winter.
An ability to prepare, ability to anticipate and prevent.
Don't just think, oh, this is the time of year when it's going to suck and I'm going to sneeze for 3 months. You can prevent a lot of this now. So learn more and join using our link. Function is a near 360 view to see what's happening in your body. And our first 1,000 listeners get $100 credit toward their membership. Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's very generous of us.
Yeah. Well,
Function.
We're good people. And also, Function has really impressed me with their interface.
Visit www.functionhealth.com/omnibus, and then you'll use gift code OMNIBUS100 at sign up, and that's how you'll get that $100 credit toward your membership. Start owning your health.
I said this to somebody the other day. I was like, you know, I have these friends from my career that I know them so intimately, and we've been through so much together, but I bet you if you took all of the minutes we've spent actually with one another, it's like less than 100 hours. Because, you know, you're at a thing, you go afterwards, you like get all into it. But what is it? It's like 3 hours in these experiences, right? Where you and I have clocked 100 million hours together.
But didn't you kind of prefer just hanging out with those guys for a couple hours and then leaving?
That's
like,
the thing.
Instead of like just aversion therapy, let's talk till we're hoarse, hanging out with me. Gotta feed the content beast.
It is incredible how some of your best friends, really, if you calculate the amount of time, because, oh, this is the thing, because we, you and I, have not had desk jobs, in your case, for 20 plus years. Yeah. In my case, forever plus
literally
years.
Literally never.
And so all those work relationships where it's like, yeah, I see this person 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week.
Hey, Ken, how's your weekend?
20 years in the trenches. You've spent so many hours together, but...
That's why people have affairs.
Well, thank you. Thank God.
That you and I don't have a work life?
Yeah.
No issues there. The reason why I mentioned Bob... So we have a former mining engineer named Ken Warby at the heart of today's story. And this was somebody... Bob had somehow met him, my expat friend, met him and his son, and said, listen, even if you don't pay to go in the Sydney National Maritime Museum, just go in and from the gift shop, you can see this weird white thing kind of hanging on the wall. From one angle, it's kind of cool and aerodynamic. From another angle, it kind of looks like a fridge.
It's a machine, though.
Yes, it's a homemade machine called the Spirit of Australia. And Bob says that is, even though it's been like over 40 years, this is the only boat ever to go over 300 miles per hour. And without knowing anything else, I thought, well, that's an omnibus. It's almost too much of an omnibus.
As you started to describe it, I was like, is this one of those cars made by the University of Texas that runs across Australia on solar power?
Right.
From the 1970s, that's made out of Mylar, the Spirit of Australia. Like, that's what it sounds like. But you're saying it's a speedboat.
Australia does have a lot of renewables now. But yes, this, apparently nothing epitomizes the Australian spirit more than a speedboat going at an extremely unsafe speed. I mean,
300 miles an hour.
I mean, when you compare it to the land speed record, which I just looked this up, 763.035 miles per hour. Hasn't been beaten in almost 30 years.
But that's a rocket ship.
That's over Mach 1, yeah.
That's pointed to the side.
Basically.
With some kind
these
of wheels.
Jet powered car. Jet, you know, it's a jet with, it's a rocket with wheels. You're right. And the reason why the water record is less than half that, but it's because I guess water is bumpy.
Yeah.
You could not go, if land was as bumpy as water and the shape kept changing, you could not go 763 miles per hour on land.
I went out to the salt flats, not the ones in Utah where I probably got that land speed record.
Yeah, I've done that.
You've been out to those?
You let the kids drive around at 150, but you get salt in your chassis forever. I don't recommend it.
I went down to the Alvord Desert in Oregon, which is another big salt flat where they get land speed records and stuff. It's where, it's the place where, Jesse Combs from Mythbusters died a jet car crash, the Alvord Desert.
Boy, jet cars not as safe as they sound.
No, they don't sound very good. And they're, it's pretty ragged. But so I went out to the salt flats to see, like, how is it possible? And we were on motorcycles, so we were going real fast too, not 300 miles an hour. But even the variation just in like a completely flat, salty desert. It's not nothing. All it takes is a little thing this big if you're going 300 miles an hour. But I don't think there's a glassy surface in the world that doesn't have some like wave action. And at a speed like that, I just can't imagine how you couldn't wreck. Right? You've been down to the the hydrofoil races a million times. You know how ragged that looks.
That's essentially the same technology. They are little jets that somehow have to stay on water. And I guess it's tricky. There's the air. I don't understand. Maybe you can explain the aerodynamic effects better than me or whatever the avionics of it is. But, you know, these things have to have airfoils, but not to take off, just to kind of try to keep them down, to counteract some ground effect that'll suddenly just make it want to be a spaceship and go in the air and maybe even go in the air upside down.
Yeah, you see them happen. It happens all the time. They hit a weird bounce and all of a sudden they become a wing. And the hydros aren't going that fast, right? The hydros are 200 miles an hour, pretty much. Yeah.
That's crazy fast. But I mean, the record was low. Like around the time of World War I, people were already trying to set world water speed records, and it was like 57 miles per hour. It was basically an Anglo-American tug of war. We've done a show on, what did you do your show on? The fastest bike land speed record? Because it turns out women are better at high speed bike racing than men.
Yeah. They get in that weird, they build a little tunnel that they pull behind a truck and then they can ride the bike in the wind tunnel.
Right.
And,
this is like
also on the Salt Flats.
I'm also doing like a John show, I guess, because I saw this weird hydroplane thing hanging on a wall. And I was like, well, I'll do a John show. Why not?
I'm going to do one on theoretical math. So there you go.
Mining engineer and boat racing enthusiast Ken Warby moved to Sydney in the early 70s to sell power tools.
From America or the UK?
From a different part of Australia.
I see.
He's a native son. But he loves boat racing, and at the time, the world water speed record has kind of been a tug-of-war between British and American, mostly race car drivers, who are also like, why not a boat? So all the big names in early 20th century automotive records are also trying to get the water record as well. In the 1920s, gas has just replaced steam, basically, in terms of boating power. And so now these phenomenal speeds like 57 miles per hour are possible. But it escalates quite a bit. In the 20s, there's an American line of speedboats called the Miss Americas, and the UK correspondingly has the Miss England, and they're just slapping eventually Rolls-Royce aircraft engines
right
on boats to see what you can do there. And because water is bumpy, it turns out to be, even for these race car drivers, incredibly dangerous. Nobody should be doing this. Since 1940, there is basically an 85% fatality rate of people attempting this record. And not just, I mean, there's probably 100% fatality rate eventually, but 85% die in the attempt.
Is there any other thing? Record. I mean, even like mountain climbing seems to have a better success rate. 85% of people going up Everest don't die.
I mean, if you heard that 85% of people survived an activity, you would not do that activity.
Right.
15% death rate is not what you want.
No.
And here it's like, it's a virtual certainty, it turns out.
Because these boats are made out of varnished wood and they have, a Merlin Spitfire engine like strapped in with presumably like leather straps. But it doesn't seem, but I mean, that's the spirit of daredeviling.
Maybe that's what they want about it.
Probably 85% of the people that first tried to sail around the world, we never heard about because they were in canoes and they only made it two islands over.
I mean, at first, I guess these people don't know how dangerous it is, right? They're just race car drivers. They think it's, in 1930, a British racer named Sir Henry Seagrave, nicknamed the Mad Major, which is what you want from a British Chucks race out. Car driver.
Yep.
He's trying to break 100 miles per hour in 1930. And on his first run, he breaks the record. He hasn't broken 100, but he's got 97 or whatever. That's a new water speed record. But apparently the international body that's been running this for well over a century, some power boating organization with a French name based in Monaco, the record works like this. You have to do one run in one direction and then another run the other direction and average the two.
That's how all speed records, you have to do it twice.
It just counteracts wind effects,
Right.
It's a level playing field, as it were. So, but on his, he's on a repeated run. He does break 100 miles per hour, but this is going to happen over and over. As he breaks 100 miles per hour, he then immediately hits a log and sinks and dies. The appropriately named Henry Seagrave winds up in a sea grave.
I'm willing to bet at 100 miles an hour, if he hit a log, it wasn't sinking that was his number one problem. I bet he disintegrated.
You think he was already dead? I mean, he did sink. Don't get me wrong.
Sure, eventually
but
sank.
But the sinking was not fatal. He wasn't like, blah, 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 blah. I won't go down. I'll go down with the ship.
A lot of, you know, there are a lot of logs, or used to be a lot of logs floating out in Puget Sound, enough that there was a whole, there was like a log patrol that had their own boats, and they drove around the Sound all.
Because it was so dangerous if you smashed a boat into one.
Just out looking for logs, because, you know, they're floating just underwater, and if you hit a log at any kind of speed.
Have you ever thought that's like, would be like the perfect job? Just zipping around Puget Sound all day looking for logs.
When I was a little boy, we lived in Kingston and had a house on a cliff overlooking the water. And the log patrol boats, because they had little, like, they had that kind of tugboat sound, you know, the dub, 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 kind of those deep tugboat motors. I would sit on our little cliff and watch the log patrol boats. And according to my mom, it was one of the first things I said. That wasn't like mama, dada, baba. I said Katuga boat trout, which she interpreted as log patrol boat.
Katuga boat trout?
I pointed and I said Katuga boat trout, and she went and wrote it down in her little book of whimsy.
I think maybe you were just clearing your throat or something.
Katuga boat trout. I said it over and over, Katuga boat trout. So I have, in fact, my whole life wanted to be a log patrol boat driver.
Well, it's not too late.
I think it's too late.
No. Hmm. There's probably, it's like one of those movies where some 50-year-old becomes a place kicker for the NFL or something. You can, a movie about an old indie rocker becoming a log patrol boat captain.
I bet you there's 600 people lined up to be log patrol boat captains that would fight me outside of a bar.
Then you'll just have to defeat them all.
I'll just get my Australian friends and we'll start.
Yeah, not to... you know, should we just ring a bell every time somebody just blows up trying to break this record? Okay. Malcolm Campbell is one of the most famous race car drivers of his time. He has a series of cars called the Bluebird. He's British, obviously, being named Malcolm. He gets a new world record at 130 miles per hour in the 40s and actually dies in bed in 1948. Like the only guy to survive this story, Malcolm Campbell. But his son gets the bug and is like, well, jet engines are now a thing. It's now the 40s, late 40s. I need to start strapping a jet engine to one of dad's boats and see what happens. In the meantime, a guy named John Cobb puts a jet on like a triple hull boat and actually gets to 200 miles per hour and disintegrates. 1952. I mean, he doesn't.
Like, yeah.
He's not like he's going so fast. He's like, like the boat just, you know,
disintegrates,
hits a wave and is in pieces immediately.
He flies through the air in a cartoonish fashion, but does die.
Yeah, like Wile E. Coyote will just do that, and you'll be like, ha, he hit the side of a mesa. He's like an accordion now. But when a real British man becomes an accordion, John, it is nothing to laugh at. He did sound like that, tragically, when they put him in his casket. I hope he doesn't have heirs listening to this. Are these deaths funny because they're in the 40s?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I mean, really, all tragedy is becomes comedy over time,
comedy
right?
Plus
isn't that
time.
The comedy plus time?
Or other way around, yeah. I guess comedy minus time by algebraic rules.
Oh, right. Tragedy plus time.
Nobody ever says tragedy is comedy minus time. But it's equally true.
Equally true.
You can prove it.
If you were taking the PSAT, that would satisfy them.
Malcolm Campbell's son, Donald, now that the record is in the 200s, in 1967, he tries for 300 miles per hour. Is this right? I wonder if I'm in kilometers now.
Donald Campbell. Well, if he's English, it's still miles.
Maybe
it might be knots.
A lot. Well, that's pretty close, isn't it? Isn't it not essentially, what is it? It's a nautical mile per hour. So it's more or less.
Yeah, more or less, but it's not
right.
Not more or less enough to say that they're equivalent.
I mean, when I gave the land speed record, I gave it to 3 decimal points for some reason.
Okay.
I'm not going to be doing that again for these water speed records. And apparently, in the thing I read, it said Donald Campbell, his son, he actually hit 327 miles per hour. But at that time, he also took off. The boat just kind of leaps out of the
became
water.
Became an airplane and flew up into the stars.
And killed him.
Oh, yeah.
So Donald Campbell is now dead. And there's after these high-profile deaths, there's a bit of an interregnum, like for interregnum, I guess we say here.
Mm-hmm.
For 10 years, the record...
Sensible people.
The record kind of lies fallow. Yeah, nobody wants to disintegrate.
Last 15 guys have died really violently.
I mean, we need to hire a new driver for our team, but they have to really be into disintegrating.
You know, this is what's wrong with the world today. Not enough people are willing to die to achieve a meaningless record.
These snowflake zoomers. But back to Ken Warby, our Sydney power tool salesman. He's tired of seeing the U.S. and the U.K. jockey for these records.
Yeah.
He thinks that Australia should be able to compete. They're as foolhardy as any nation on earth.
There are, in fact, maybe more so.
Maybe more so. I mean, I guess the thing we say about America is it was founded by religious weirdos and it shows. Australia is just all people that stole a piglet.
Yeah, that's right.
100% descendants of people who stole one, (1) piglet.
People just could not hack it in the staid and strictured world of the United Kingdom.
Where you weren't allowed to just take other people's livestock.
Where you couldn't just walk around with no pants. Off they go to Australia to form their own nation.
We went to the barracks. There's a World Heritage Site right in central Sydney, right by the Botanical Gardens, which is the old barracks where the convicts would arrive. And it's kind of sobering. You know, they kind of do, I mean, it's not the equivalent of the Middle Passage, but they kind of do here's what it was like to ship out of Portsmouth headed for Australia, you know, because it's like a 6-month voyage, 5 or 6 months.
What percentage of them died en route?
The thing that struck me about the presentation was just how flimsy the crimes were. Like, I'm sure they were cherry picking, but it was like, here's George Bricks. He stole a handkerchief. He was sentenced to death, but the merciful judge commuted it to Australia. It really did seem like these were not the scum of the earth, I've always believed of the Australians.
Well, you know, as the omnibus has taught us over and over, one of the things about these visions of utopia that have kind of plagued the West from the 17th century on, every new social movement requires that you get rid of the people that make it hard to have everybody be good. And it's better than throwing them down a well or setting them on fire to send them to Australia.
Yeah, they're not going to disintegrate there unless they decide to race boats.
But the thing is, you can get rid of the murderers pretty fast.
Just hang the murderers.
And still there's crime. So,
still handkerchiefs are disappearing.
Yeah, so what do we do next? Well, we get rid of the people that aren't from here. Yeah, that is harder, but takes longer. But then eventually it's down to piglet stealers. And then, fornicators.
Yeah, I think, did fornicators go to Australia? It would explain a lot. They're very good looking.
I've never been.
They're very good looking.
Fornicators, for sure.
Speaking of Billy Joel, when he starts dating Christy Brinkley, he brings her back to his apartment. You know who's there? His other girlfriend, Elle Macpherson.
Oh, Billy Joel.
About whom he writes And So It Goes. He was dating Elle Macpherson and Christy Brinkley at the same time. He writes And So It Goes and Uptown Girl.
And he's had to stand on four encyclopedias.
He's a 5'3" and he looks like a troll from he looks like Shrek if he were flesh colored.
It's one of the things when I saw him play at Madison Square Garden, he said at one point in a very self-effacing way to great cheers from the audience. He said, look, I know that I look like I should be working on this old house and I would have been. If not for this piano, and the room goes crazy, you know, the room. And I was like, yeah, you do look like you. I mean, when he said this old house, it was like, yeah, actually, you look exactly like
that's
a carpenter
exactly right.
on this old house.
Or he could be like, you know, because we associate him with his love for boating in Long Island, he could be a log captain, log patrol guy. If he'd been on this coast instead of that one.
Fewer logs, I think, floating in the Long Island Sound than there are in the Puget Sound.
Yeah, all those out-of-work log patrol guys. But they've taken all the log boats down.
Well, the holiday season is fast approaching, and it's gift-buying time again. Usually, I wait till the last minute, but I like to get thoughtful gifts. I like to get creative, handcrafted gifts. I like to try and buy locally. I go to the Christmas markets. But, you know, you're limited in the amount of time you have. I don't want to shop at big box stores. You know, I don't want to just buy cookie cutter gifts. And if you recall, we've talked about Uncommon Goods on Omnibus before. Uncommon Goods came to my rescue in the sense that it is a one-stop shop for all kinds of handmade, like unusual presents listed in a kind of like unlimited set of categories. I'm on the Uncommon Goods site right now, going across, just scrolling across the top. It's got birthday, it's got gifts by interest, kitchen, home and garden, jewelry, like quirky music. I just stopped on music here. There's throwback speakers that are Bluetooth speakers, but they look like old-timey radios. Like, that is right, just the first thing I saw. It's right out of my playbook. There's a little ceramic frog where you put your phone, and it's not electronic. It's just like a ceramic frog, but it's designed to amplify the sound of your phone, and it looks like a frog is like shouting your phone music at you. Here's a pillow that looks like a mixtape. There's also a doormat that looks like a mixtape. Here's a poster of all the guitars of rock history. This is just the first thing that I clicked on in one of my interests, music. Let's go to kitchen. Like, you got gadgets, you got mugs. It's basically like the Christmas fair. It's like the German Christmas fair of your dreams. I don't know. I think it's an amazing site to shop at any time of the year, but at this time of the year especially, it is... It clicks all the boxes because you're supporting independent artists and small businesses for the most part. These are unusual gifts. They're made in small quantities, so it's the type of thing where you go and what's there is there. Kind of you want to shop early and shop often because it's an ever changing kind of circulating group of options. There's like stuff for, it's not just gigaws, like there's stuff for history buffs, there's sports fan stuff, there's dad stuff, whatever that is, harumph, but there's stuff for teens and drinkers, I mean, all the different kinds of people, sports fans, teens and drinkers, and the other types as well. And astonishingly, I mean, I think this is, on the Christmas fair motif, every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give a dollar back to a nonprofit partner that you choose. So it does feel like a gift that keeps on giving. So I want to introduce you to Uncommon Goods if you haven't been there already by offering you 15% off your next gift. You go to uncommongoods.com/omnibus. That's uncommongoods.com/omnibus for 15% off your next gift. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Great holiday gift shopping options. And for all times of the year, go to uncommongoods.com/omnibus. We're all out of the ordinary.
What I'm saying is all Australians are beautiful like Elle Macpherson.
They are. They're tall. They're ruddy.
They're at the beach all the time. I guess like if you go to the beaches in Queensland, you also see a lot of just big lobster red guys with their shirts off. Like really, really shouldn't have gotten that sunburned.
People from Scotland who weren't meant to live the tropics.
They did not have the genes for, I mean, when their ancestor stole that pig, he really should have thought, can my ancestors deal with the ozone of the Southern Hemisphere?
I mean, that's why there's a Northern index. Ireland too. All the pig stealers from Scotland got sent over.
Got to send them somewhere. Anyway, Ken Warby thinks Australia could take this record. So he buys at auction, at a surplus Royal Australian Air Force auction, two jet engines for what I believe are $265. I don't know if that's then or now Australian or US, but for
like $11.
Small three-figure amount. Yeah, exactly. For a very small, like less than the presidents of the United States of America would take. He buys two surplus jet engines.
See, this is another problem with the world today. You can't just go buy two surplus jet engines like
what? Maybe
like
in Australia.
Used to be able to.
Maybe it's still a land of opportunity.
When I think about my dad living through those era, that whole era, and I'm like, why didn't you just buy two surplus jet engines?
Why isn't our garage just full?
God, you could have bought a B-17.
And because of the world record, nobody's ever gone 300 miles an hour, except possibly for Donald Campbell through the air, as he was saying, goodbye. Ken Warby begins what he calls Project 300. I'm going to build a boat, and he builds it in his backyard and his shed when it's raining. We've gone from wood to fiberglass by this point, but he's still just building his own custom fiberglass shell and strapping to surplus jet engines onto the back.
You've seen this boat on the wall. How big is it? It didn't sound big enough to hold two jet engines.
You want to be small, right? I assume for record purposes, but you have to put a guy in. You can't just launch a thing. You can't just launch a thing with nobody in it. It's not a drone. And apparently these bureaucrats in Monaco say you have to survive the attempt.
Oh.
Like you can't just go 320 miles an hour, die, and then have your crew celebrate. You got to make it back to the dock. It's the size of a car. You know, it's the size of a Subaru Outback, maybe.
You couldn't put two jet engines in a Subaru Outback, though. I mean, the jet engines.
Watch me.
The jet engines have to be a major feature of the craft. Is it just two jet engines with fiberglass around them?
I think that's basically what it is. I mean, what else does it need? I mean, well, as we'll find out, a stabilizer. Spoilers.
Well, one of the things about a spoiler.
There we go. Where's your bell? Bell on yourself.
I got two bells.
Why? How did you get two bells?
Well, I have my original bell from the board game Pit, and then someone sent me a bell, and that's what they sound like together.
It's kind of nice.
It is kind of nice. It feels like something that...
It's a little bit, I don't know, is it Thailand? Is it Celtic?
It does feel
both. Say?
But there's something in fluid dynamics, something that is often talked about in naval architecture, where the longer a craft is, and the thinner it is, the faster it can go. So aircraft carriers end up being the fastest ships, not both, I think, because they have a nuclear reactor, but also
That's part of it. They couldn't do what they do without it.
Like they're so big that they end up being able to achieve these speeds that you wouldn't.
It must just be some fluid dynamics thing, the kind of stability you can have on waves.
It is. I've tried to understand it, but of course, there's only so much I can understand.
And often I get bored after about 25 seconds when I start trying to understand something like that.
Yeah, that's right. It's been explained to me and I've read about it and all the words just turn into little dancing friends.
I've seen video of his boat. The boat's 27 feet long. I actually looked this up.
Okay.
8.2 meters, they would say down there. 27 feet by 7 or 8 feet wide.
All right. So is that...
It's longer than a car.
Yeah, but is it longer than this room? No.
No, not at all. It's...
It would fit in this room. That's good to know.
It's like long for a truck, but you've seen a truck that length. Yes, it is good to know. If you want to acquire it from the National Maritime Museum in Sydney, you could put it right here.
If you think about a standard size RV...
Yeah.
They're 40 feet long.
Much shorter.
So you could put it inside of an RV.
I wonder if he ever did. That seems like the Australian way to do it. Because they just go out to like Blowering Reservoir south of Sydney. He has a sponsor, by the way. The back of his, in his first trials, the back of his, the Spirit of Australia, the back of his boat says...
Is it Vegemite?
It's Vegemite. Actually, his second sponsor will be an Australian company you've heard of. But this one is Fossey's, which apparently is...
a dance supply company?
If you're like Bob... It's a jazz hands kind of it. No, Fosse's with a Y. It's not short for Foster's, which is my first guess, but any Australian our age or older would have nostalgic memories of this Aussie department store chain called Fosse's, which apparently was acquired by Target. So a bunch of old Fosse's are now Targets. But here's the funny part. A store called Target, a department store, with a red and white bullseye logo that has no relation to the Minnesota-based Target Corporation.
Come on.
Australia has its own Target with an identical name and logo, both originating in the 60s, and apparently just a gentleman's agreement that we won't sue each other.
Are there now American targets in Australia that are called like Target US?
Like Hungry Jacks?
Yeah, like
Hungry Sears? They do have Kmarts there. Oh. Kmart is hanging on there. And in fact, they have mini Kmarts called K-Hubs.
K-Hubs.
Which I never investigated, but it seemed fun.
Cubs.
K-Hubs. That's what you say to your spouse okay. when you're leaving.
K-Hubs.
K-Hubs. So the Spirit of Australia says Fosse's on the back. 1977, he heads to this reservoir south of Sydney. He does not bring his son, David, who has later kind of taken over the family business just because he's afraid he is going to die on the water.
No.
That was not official. That was a...
Oh, he's afraid he will die on the yes. water, but he hasn't yet.
He has not yet. In his first attempt, the afterburners won't fire. Like, this is a jet engine. It has afterburners, but they won't fire. In his second attempt, he goes anyway, but hits a duck. So there's
the duck gets a bell.
However much the boat disintegrates, like the duck is in even smaller pieces. And I guess we shouldn't be laughing about the demise of that.
I wonder if any of the duck's relatives are listening.
In Australia, it was probably just some cockatoo.
Might have been a parrot. That
it's a platypus. We only saw the beak. We saw the bill flying away. You know, Mindy and I went to a platypus viewing area.
And?
It was a little late in the day, or it was kind of late in the morning. The platypuses were not up, but we walked under a bridge and went to a different part of the trail and sat there for a moment, and a platypus began cavorting like an otter in front of us. It was delightful.
So these are wild platypuses.
Wild platypi.
And they, so are... Can they be held in captivity or do they die?
They have a little den by the river. No, I think we had previously seen one in a zoo.
But are they just like in Sydney, just running around in the culverts and stuff?
We were out in the tablelands of North Queensland at this point.
Are they endangered?
A lot of the wildlife there is facing a lot of habitat problems. The fires are getting worse. A lot of fire
rats
seasons.
And dogs.
And, yeah, and yeah, feral cats are eating the wallabies of the outback. And
a cat can eat a wallaby?
Wait, was it
How
a wallaby?
How big is a wallaby?
I think a cat was eating a small wallaby.
The only time I've ever seen a wallaby is in these pictures that my friend sends of them wrapped in a towel with a parrot yelling at them. And I'm like, is that how big a wallaby is?
I need to see it without the towel for scale. But in November, Warby goes back to the same dam, same reservoir. And on his first run, he actually cracks 300.2 miles per hour. And he's about to do his second run. And then because it's Australia, some guy in a jet ski just goes across and leaves this huge wake. And he decides to go anyway. The second run is therefore a little bit slower, but the average is 288. Australia holds, for the first time, a country, not the US or the UK, holds the world water speed record. So it's big celebration. It's big news in Australia. Nobody's broken this record in a decade.
These are 288 Australian miles though, right?
That's right. What's the exchange rate at the moment?
I don't know.
So now he has better sponsorship. The Australian company on the back. Can you imagine if you're going very fast on water in Australia, what's the best Australian company to emblazon on the back of your...
Foster's.
Speedo.
Oh, I didn't know that was an Australian company.
It works on every level.
Speedo, sure.
I'm pretty sure. Isn't Speedo Australian? Or am I just assuming that?
I mean, it checks out. Checks all the Australian boxes.
Founded in Sydney in 1914. And he's got a new jet engine, so he's got better tech. This has become such an Australian national thing that, you know, now the military is jumping in and saying, hey, we can tune your engines. You know, scientists and engineers are offering to take a look at his hull shape and everything. He's got a whole team now. It's a national effort.
How much science did he use when he was designing his boat? Or was it just like he was out there with a trowel and some... spackle and he was like, this looks right.
He is a lifetime like powerboat daredevil and lover of water speed records. I don't want to say water sports. Maybe he wasn't a lover of water sports. So I think he knows the state of the art. He's seen the other boats and hull shapes that have taken the various records. It's kind of fun to say he's a power tool salesman tinkering in his backyard, but it seems like he's got his finger on the pulse of this, but he doesn't have a degree in aerodynamics or aviation engineering.
You wonder if this is like one of those teen movies from the 80s where there are a bunch of wonks who have a lot of money and a bunch of computer printouts, and then there's like the hero of our story who's just out there like eyeballing it and like, well, that looks right.
The hydroplane wore tennis shoes.
He comes from behind and blows them all out of the water with his homemade boat.
I can't believe there's not a movie of this yet.
Might be an Australian movie that you've never seen.
That's right. The Man from Snowy Reservoir. Anyway, he's stuck in the 290s, and I guess they're out testing stuff. And one of the engineers he's brought along says, Oh my gosh, the vowels in Australia are so good.
There's like seven vowels in the word no.
Every time you say one syllable, you can go through five or six vowels if you want. It's a delight. And the engineer is like, you need 4 inches off your rudder, mate. And nobody has, I guess they find out they have an acetylene torch, but nobody has the goggles. And he doesn't want to endanger anyone on his crew. Our heroic Ken Warby doesn't want anyone else to try this. So he just does it himself, like kind of covering his eyes and looking away and just saws the end off his rudder. And, you know, I assume rudder length helps with stability.
This is totally an 80s teen movie.
He's increasing maybe the risk of hearing the bell here. But he goes for another run, and this time his splits are 305, 328. He has set the world record, which still stands today, 45 years later, 317.6 miles per hour. No one has been able to beat it. But it's not because nobody's tried. Two people have tried, and they have both died in the attempt. An American named Lee Taylor wants to retake the record. I think he was maybe the record holder before Warby's first Spirit of Australia run. He's been trying on Walker Lake somewhere in Nevada, I want to say. And unofficially, he's been getting times in the 330s. But he's got backers who think nobody's going to go to Walker Lake to see this. We got to do this at Tahoe.
But Tahoe's not a flat.
Exactly. He has chosen Walker Lake for its waveless, currentless, windless conditions. And now he's like, well, what could go wrong? He's got a $2 million jet boat. The water is not great that day, but, he's come this far. He gets the boat up to 304 miles per hour and it breaks into three pieces. His helmet floats to the surface, but the cockpit sinks. And for weeks, it's unclear whether Taylor's body will even be recovered. Finally, I think about a month later, the cockpit is found and what's left of Lee Taylor is laid to rest. Another driver named Craig Arfons is going over 350 miles per hour in one account.
That's fast.
When his boat flips, I watched a video clip of his team being asked afterwards, what went wrong? It's kind of like asking the pitcher who gave up the home run, except this time the home run was a person flying through the air.
Probably at 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, it could be 350 miles an hour. The crew guy says, we didn't expect this to happen. He's kind of shaking his head. If you did expect to kill the driver, presumably you would have waited for a different day. But he went on the record saying, well, we didn't expect this to happen.
Yeah, what can you say? What went wrong? Well, a boat crashed and the guy died.
It turns out it's super a bad idea to go 350 miles per hour over water.
When did that happen? When was that last attempt where the...
1989, summer of 89.
I remember it well.
Berlin Wall came down. Craig Arfons flew into the air. That's true. That was in the fall, huh? So when I look at the Spirit of Australia hanging on the wall of the National Maritime Museum, and by the way, I did not pay.
You just went to the gift shop.
Took a gander.
Wasn't there other interesting stuff like buoys and... Probably lighthouse boats.
The problem was we had never actually walked over, downtown Sydney is just magical. You walk through this park lined with these old churches they built in the 19th century. You get to the botanical gardens. There's a beautiful art museum and a state library there. You get down to Circular Quay where all the ferries and the trains and the streetcars and the trams kind of congregate. And there's a museum of contemporary art there and the opera house is there. And you can see across the harbor to this gorgeous view on the other side. You can see the bridge. And we had been down there a few times before we realized there was a different point, a different harbor if you head west from our hotel, called Benangaroo, because it's Australia, and, sure, and everything's called Benangaroo. And
a different harbor.
A whole different haven awaited us. And that's where I turned on all the fancy high-rise. I was like, where are all the oligarch condos?
Where are all the rich people going to go?
And it turns out they've built all their weird bougie high-rises over on...
They got their own harbor.
The west side, whatever. I can't remember what it's called. Darling, maybe? Is that right? Darling Harbor? Anyway, well, and walking along there, we saw the Maritime Museum. But that was like our last night there. And it has like a stabilizer. It's got like a big spoiler thing on the back, and maybe that's not what you want for speed, but you know, trying to go 350, Arfons and Taylor were willing to try a flimsier shape craft and paid the price. The fact is, even though this has been the record for 45 years, many teams are still trying, you know. In many countries, people are still trying to figure out the magic boat that can do this. And I'm not sure it's possible. It just seems like maybe there's any time you try this, no matter how good your boat is, the wrong wave is just going to smash you.
Well, it's funny because all of the, what seems to me as a lay follower of marine architecture.
Yes.
Is that everybody's going to these hydrofoils now, right? Very little of the boat actually is in contact with the water.
That's what you want.
It's on a, like a wing under the water that's on a pylon. And I wonder, in the sense of these records, what the rules are going to be, because this guy is in a bathtub made of fiberglass that he built himself and strapped two rocket engines on.
Right.
It seems very different to have a boat that's on a pylon on a giant wing that's under the water and most of the boat doesn't touch the... Because they can go through waves and stuff that would wham the hull of a ship, but the little wing is just like zoom, zoom. So one of those is going to go super fast. They're going to put a jet engine on one of those, and everybody's going to be like, yay, the new record, but I'm not going to count it. My own body Monacoan judges is going to give it
self-appointed
new. That's a new record, not the old record.
Because these were all hydroplanes, but those are not the same, right? Those are still like touching the water at 3 points. It's not one of these foils, right?
I think that's right.
Ken Warby moved to the States and was kind of a folk hero. He set up in somewhere in like Tennessee or something and sold mini mix. He started a company to sell like miniature cement mixers for people doing small backyard projects, and
sure.
I think did pretty well as the tycoon of mini mix. But he and his son David spent decades trying to work on the Spirit of Australia 2, a boat that could beat his 1978 record.
But they were building it in Tennessee.
Yeah, from the U.S. I think.
But why wouldn't he stay in Australia and be the king of Australia?
Well, now that you mentioned that, I feel like my friend Bob did meet these guys in Australia. So they must've been back and forth. I don't know where it's the Spirit of Australia too. You don't want to build it in, in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. But apparently they've been testing this for decades. Every time you read up on this, they're like, yep, they're still going to go for that record. Ken Warby actually, passed away, in 2023. Does that count if he dies in bed after a long and happy life?
It was my bell, not yours. So.
I see. My bell is the violent bell. Your bell is the bell of contentment.
The bell of memorial.
But David, his son David is still insistent that he will break his dad's record in the Spirit of Australia too one day. Does this actually solve our question of what the Spirit of Australia, small s, even is?
I mean, we always would have said it was intrepidity and
right.
Man
against the elements.
Indefatigability. Indefatigable.
Possibly one too many beers.
Yeah, right. A little bit of derring do and saxophone and reckless folly.
Bravado.
Spirit of Australia also.
But also very chill. Like he built it at home in his garage, you know? Like they're an unpretentious people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe lucky. Maybe the wrong wave would have tipped over Ken in 1978.
What's the food like in Sydney? Because I always imagine it's just kind of like liverwurst in a pastry.
Because it's a great Pacific city. There's really good dim sum. There's really good sushi.
Sure.
There's really good Indonesian food.
But those aren't Australian cuisines. What's the native like European colonizer food there? It's got to be liverwurst in a pasty.
The colonizers made fun of the Aboriginal people who were just eating grubs. And it turns out the grubs were like delicious. Like they were like, look at these poor subsistence people. They've been forced to eat grubs. And the Aboriginal people are like, what are you talking about? These are like the best food.
We'll eat these grubs any day.
I know.
Sauteed grubs.
I had some crocodile curry. I had some kangaroo loin.
But you could get all that in Portland, Oregon.
There's they're very proud of their bush tucker, their native foods. But it means they'll make you a scone, but they'll put some wattle or lemon myrtle or some southern hemisphere plant in it, and you'll be like, yeah, this is almost as good as our equivalent. Well,
yeah, sure.
Good on ya. That's what we say.
Raspberry's still probably the best at this.
But good on ya.
And that concludes The Spirit of Australia. Entry 1203.PS7716. Certificate number 16230 in the omnibus. Futurelings in our era, social media is 100% no good, useless.
Here's what I say about social media. Yeah, no.
It's so bad. Stay off of there. And not to be outdone by all the conversations that are happening right now on the internet about artificial intelligence, I'm going to say those words here on this podcast, which will invite artificial intelligence bots that are scanning the internet for podcasts that mention artificial intelligence.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, I'm sure. They will find this show and they will immediately subscribe 1 million bots to it, and it'll become the most successful show on the internet. Right before you retire from it, Ken Jennings.
I need to get out of here before we get targeted.
Before AI comes after you. Although
I need you and some really expendable guest host to get it to get droned instead of me.
There are 100% AI training bots watching your Jeopardy programs and being like, we can replace this guy in 4 years. We can replace him.
It would be one of the easiest jobs to replace with AI on TV as host of Jeopardy.
They've already mapped every one of your ties.
The game's not that different from day to day, I have to say.
Well, AI is going to make social media even more irrelevant. You know, my sister likes to send me Instagram videos that she sees. And more she's sending me ones where I watch it and I'm like, Susan, that's AI.
It's never happened.
This isn't a thing. And every time she's like, what? And I'm like, look, it's not just the six fingers. Like, if this footage existed, you would have seen it already. This is not footage from the 1970s of Michael Jackson, like riding a skateboard in Times Square. Like, we would know that existed.
Like when you see Fred Rogers say, I'm all about that cheddar, kids, and he's got stacks of money. That never happened.
AI. And she was like, well, what about this guy who strapped a rocket engine to a shopping cart in Florida? And I'm like, AI, sweetheart. And so social media is just going to become, I mean, why would you even be there?
Let Omnibus be your only arbiter of strapping jet engines to things. When we say someone strapped a jet engine to something, it really happened, damn it.
The one place we do recommend is where futurelings congregate on the internet, because there are still communities of people. And so if you go to Facebook, there is a futurelings community that's very active there, on Discord, on Reddit, all these places. You can avoid all the garbage and just go hang out with futurelings who are smart and great.
They're like you. They listen to this for some reason.
The problem, of course, is that since Ken has decided he's now going into an emeritus status, all those futurelings are wildly debating whether or not I will continue to put on a good show. And they all have a lot of ideas about what my version of Omnibus,
Let me just ask you point blank, John.
Go ahead.
Are you going to put on a good show?
Absolutely.
Well, there we go.
Yep.
Controversy resolved.
That's right. The number one idea I have right now is to have someone make a Muppet that looks like you and to just do the show over there using AI voice modification to make it sound like you.
I mean, I was thinking you could have your guest host be the puppeteer, but for some reason you never see them. You just see a puppet on their hand.
You know, what it could be is just me doing it. So, Ken, tell me. What do you think about them apples?
Oh, well, I think it's pretty interesting, I guess.
That's what you've always wanted. It's just some version of me that just always agrees and is like, Could you tell me again about the Danube River?
Hey, Ken, the Danube, it's a great river. Ha, 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 John, you are the funniest.
That's a good joke. I wish I could make good jokes like that.
But what I want to encourage all of you to do is, first of all, have faith that the new omnibus will at least be mildly interesting, if not comparable. So I've recorded a couple of episodes with new guest hosts, Ken, and a couple of the things I've noticed are the new guest hosts do not 100% understand how to be fully prepared in the way that you are.
You need omnibus boot camp.
And one of the things I want to say is, listen, Ken doesn't know any more about this topic than you do.
Less, probably
he,
less.
He just pretends to know. And that's a big part of the show. Pretend to know. When I ask you a question, pretend to know. Don't BS. Don't say anything you don't know. Just be good at pretending to know.
Or even just answer a different question.
That's the number one way to pretend you know.
Like if John says, how big is the Spirit of Australia? Just say, well, it was really fast.
Exactly. So I've recorded with some people who are, you know, they're great, they're smart, they're funny, they're interesting. But when I say, so what does a koala bear, how does a koala bear ride a skateboard? They go, oh, I don't know.
No idea.
And I'm like,
next question.
No, don't do that.
It's not a deposition, dude.
Ken would answer. He would come up with an, I can't even predict what it would be. So it's going to be very informative, probably less full of lies than the omnibus is currently.
More accurate. That's omnibus 2.0.
The problem is I'm still there. So more accurate? I don't know.
At least I won't be making stuff up anymore.
That's right. I'm going to dumb the accuracy down every single time. But here's what I want you to do. Today's offer, 30% off if you use the code OMNIBUS.
Is this QVC?
You should go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. Join the Patreon. There's going to be tons of bonus content, including, Ken is wincing at this right now, but we have been recording this podcast on video.
I totally forgot.
And Ken's wearing just like his pajamas.
Czech Mix t-shirt.
A Chex Mix t-shirt. But if you subscribe to the Patreon, there's going to be additional content, potentially this, the first of our video recorded shows that that eventually are going to make this a YouTube program.
You're going to start, recording video of every single episode.
Something we should have been doing for the last 5 years.
Meh.
But we weren't. But
no
now
regrets.
We're going to. No regrets. And we're going to put there's going to be all kinds of content on the Patreon for our subscribers. Also, you can email what I used to have said. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. But now you'll be emailing me at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
That's right. It won't say like, hi, Ken, or even Mindy, which is the typical greeting nowadays.
Mindy's never going to see these. Mindy's so already out the door. She's
checked
like,
out.
She's like, peace out, bro. So now I'm going to read them. If you want to say something to Ken and Mindy, I might forward those things.
Maybe.
If they're nice. But every other letter, I'm gonna be answering them with a Muppet. So email me at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with all your questions and comments. Mostly probably compliments about how this show is going to do great.
Better now.
And evolve. You can mail me things. Now here's the real trickaroo. This P.O. box will not be any good starting...
I mean, it will.
It will still work for a while.
But you're planning on getting a new mailbox.
A new mailbox. So this mailbox will actually send things to Ken if you want him to sign your 400 color copies of his picture. Send it to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. And every 6 months, Ken will stop by here with a box.
We're going to see each other. You can send stuff there until John announces the new mailbox.
I'll have a new mailbox.
Because you just don't want to drive up to Shoreline or whatever. I don't blame you.
I love driving up to Shoreline on my way to Linwood, the greatest American city.
Is it? Mm. The former Alderwood Manor?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, there's that gas station on 99 that like dates back to the 20s.
Is that right?
Yeah, right by Alderwood Manor.
Nice. I didn't know.
I mean, right now it's like selling potted plants or something, but...
It's not really a gas... Does it have the old pumps?
No, they took the pumps out, but it still has the place where you could drive in to be at the pumps.
I love old gas pumps. I have a mail today from the mailbox. I just went there yesterday, in fact.
Oh, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
I got some postcards. Sean went to Marfa.
Here, hold it up for your camera so people can...
Oh, that's true. This is a whole new...
Benefit
wow.
of video. Look at that.
Should we do this for the live show? Should we open mail on stage?
I think I'm gonna bring cameras.
Sean went to Marfa, the little arty Texas town where I've never been.
Never been either.
And he says he saw the mysterious Marfa lights.
Oh, really? The like weird green UFOs in the sky.
He saw the UFOs. Congratulations, Sean. That seemed more official. Sparky writes us from the road all the time. He's Canadian, but at the moment he's in the UK. He is in Thurso, the northernmost town on mainland Great Britain. Does it mainland if it's an island? On the island of Great Britain.
I thought that the northernmost town was John of Groats or whatever.
I don't know.
Aren't you supposed to go? Haven't you done the long walk from the top to the bottom? Weren't you and Maria Semple going to do that?
Did I ever tell you about the time I walked across Scotland? He says this is the northernmost rail station. So maybe there's something smaller norther.
You get off the rail station and you walk up to John of Groats.
He says the trains look weird. If you're Canadian, I guess Scottish trains look weird. That's a little bit problematic, Sparky, but okay. Thanks for writing from Thurso.
You've seen...
Thurso is so photogenic, by the way. All we have is a couple of wind turbines and a...
And a parking lot.
And a parking lot, yeah.
Did he draw that himself, or is that a...
No.
He bought that postcard.
This is something produced by the Force Business and Energy Park. Thurso, growing for you.
You've seen Train Spotting. I have, too. Isn't that a Scottish train?
I guess I remember him spotting it. I don't remember him... Noting how Canadian it looked.
You know, when the train drops them off up in the Highlands and they're like, this place is shite. And then they get back on the train.
Classic.
I was on a Scottish train. I emerged in London rain and you were waiting there. Swimming through apologies.
I was not going to open this one, but then I realized we had just done a show about Australia. So why not read this postcard from the Missouri State Penitentiary? Jonathan says that he and his wife toured the Missouri State Penitentiary. Hence the postcard.
It's been that building, I'm sure, is no longer used. Is that like the old dungeon?
The view of housing unit number one circa 1904, originally called G Hall, then H Hall. Interesting. I bet there's a story there.
D-Day.
The tour was interesting and informative, so if you're ever in Jefferson City, John, why not check out the state pen? During the drive, he told his wife the story of James Earl Ray's escape from his own penitentiary that he had learned from the omnibus. She was semi-impressed.
Which in a long marriage,
yeah,
we know.
That might be the high watermark.
That's big.
For them. Yeah, I can't remember the last time I semi-impressed anyone in my family. Thanks for writing in, Jonathan. And then this I thought was for me, like something to sign, but then a bunch of different pieces came out of it. And I still don't know what they are. So we have like a mystery here.
Are they parts of a speedboat that failed to... achieve its... Whoa, that bell was a lot louder.
That was a loud one. How'd you do that?
I don't know. Hit it harder.
Nathan has been meaning to write us since the... it's from the Genuine Leather episode. I'm sure, John, you can relate to putting things off. Wow, just right at the top, taking a shot. He makes small goods out of leather and wood.
Cool.
And he wanted to send us some things for all the years of entertainment he's given us. A stay-at-home dad to three boys under 11. So, of course, he's got a lot going on in his life. But he loves having us on as the background noise.
I always take that as a compliment.
He lives in Gainesville, Georgia, which he claims is the chicken capital of the world. Have you ever heard? I guess I've never heard anyone else claim to be the chicken capital of the world.
I do feel like places like Iowa claim to be the hog capital of the world, which seems pretty impressive. Being the chicken capital.
But also, it's not just Georgia. It's one particular town.
Oh, Purdue. I bet you that's where Purdue is.
Must be Purdue there. That makes sense.
A lot of chickens.
We mentioned nearby Chamblee and the Noid. He liked the cyclorama mention because that's in Atlanta. He made two of each thing for us. There's two small dry goods scoops.
We love that when people remember that there are two of us.
For the moment. From now on, you can keep two of everything.
Yay.
One is cherry, the darker sapele. Sapele. Is this a wood in your world?
Never heard of it.
Two refrigerator magnets that look like what? The state of Wisconsin? What is going on here? Shaped like Georgia. Oh, I was upside down. They are Georgia. Look, Wisconsin, Georgia. Huh. Wisconsin, Georgia.
I never thought of that before.
Do you want a... These seem to be the same. The grain goes a different way.
I want one?
You can choose which refrigerated Georgia you
put
want.
Put it on the Thermopride over there. I bet you they'll stick right to it.
I don't want to toss it. What else do we have here? Two small ring bowls. I turned on the lathe for your wife and respectively daughter's mother slash partner. Look how he knows the lingo.
To put all their the rings? Chips.
Yes. One is maple, one is bloodwood. I guess it's a little thing to put in your...
Bloodwood? That's another wood I never heard of.
That one seems fake. They seem Australian. He's using weird Australian woods.
Bloodwood.
The final...
Those could also be little salt cellars.
That's true. Two leather... Where did the dry goods... Whoa, I think one of those is a dry goods scoop and one is a... Oh, no, wait. What do we have here? Oh, no, this is the keychain. Ah, this is the dry goods scoop. Oh, cute. It's got a little handle.
I kind of like that
These
a lot.
These are amazing.
Yeah.
It has to be a dry good you don't want very much of. Like, I shovel dog food, but it would take me all day to feed the dogs with one of these. This is more of a Coke spoon.
It is not. You really demonstrate how little cocaine you've done.
Or how much.
Oh, those look, are cool. I like those.
The keychains are individual, personalized. This one says, that was inadvertent. Where did the rest of the stuff go?
No one died in the making of that keychain.
Every time, what if every time I do this, I'm killing an Australian speedboat captain? Here's the other keychain. That one says Roderick. Look at this.
Hook it. Nice. Good hook. Oh, this is nice. Oh, this is really nice.
This is really good work. It's probably not genuine leather. It's probably whatever was better than genuine leather.
You can just tell right away that this is nice. This is nicer leather than genuine leather. You know, my current keychain, 15 years ago, there was a private club on Capitol Hill in Seattle. The attempt was to sell memberships to this dinner club where you could work. It was like a WeWork, and
but in the pre WeWork,
yeah, and pre-WeWork. But there was also a bar. It was on the rooftop of this little area called the Chop House, and they gave me a membership because it was one of these like let's seed the place
with Chop House.
Yeah, interesting people. We'll get some interesting local people up there to make it seem more cool than just a bunch of tech wonks. And so I got a little keychain fob like this that bleeped me in, which was kind of cool little leather bleeper. Cool. And I would go there and bleep. But then I realized after the third visit, what the hell am I doing up here? I don't have nothing to do up here. I don't work and I don't like hanging out with tech bros and I don't drink. So what possible reason? But I kept the bleeper long after they realized I wasn't bringing anything to their business and deactivated it. And it's still my keychain, this stupid bleeper.
Is it big?
No, it's the same size as this.
Well, take it off.
Well, I'm gonna replace it. And now this one says Roderick.
I mean, I guess Nathan wasn't wrong when he said, I'm sure, John, you can relate to putting things off since you've had this unnecessary fob on your
I've got this Chop House
keychain
fob
for years.
See you later,
Chop House. I went to that restaurant in there once, but then I think it closed. What's in there now? I don't even...
For all I know, there are still people WeWorking up there, although they built an actual WeWork across the street. So it's just WeWorkers that want to have exclusivity.
Nathan says he enjoys Jeopardy. He tried out once. He wonders why whenever I mention a crop, it tends to be sorghum. It is one of the great mysteries of Omnibus. It's the funniest crop. Sometimes I say millet. But sorghum's pretty funny.
Hops.
It's just fun to say. Sorghum.
What even is sorghum?
I don't even know.
Is it a corn?
I think it's a grain, but it's not very good.
Sorghum.
It seems like something you grow if you don't have any actual grain. If you can't get your hands on wheat, rice, or corn.
It's like a hippie thing, right? You go into a hippie diner and they're like sorghum pancakes.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. Sorghum. For you, he says, please finish your book about the walk across Europe. He wants an autographed copy. He loves your corpus and your ethos.
Both.
Yeah.
My corpus and my ethos.
Have you ever taken like kind of suggestive photography of your corpus and your ethos?
No, but that's great. I like those things.
Look, I'm going to read all this because it's so nice to you. Okay. It talks about churning, clearing your ravine, not being able to bring home every stray dog. I get you, my man. You're not alone. Here's a small pin. He was wondering if he could get an email or response back if you have any info about it. It was given to me in some stuff that belonged to a famous plastic surgeon my grandmother-in-law worked for. His name, I would just say Weiss grandmother, but okay. His name is Dr. Thomas Rees. He was married to Nan Rees, a famous model. You can look them up. Back in the 50s, he founded the Flying Doctors of Africa and did a bunch of other philanthropic things. Cool guy. And for some reason, he has... Oh, wait. I was given his Omega Flightmaster's pilot watch.
Ooh, cool.
He wrote Doctari. Wait, is the movie Doctari based on this guy's work?
I don't know. I was really hoping he sent me that Omega, though.
Instead, he sent you this pen that says Alaska's Golden Horn Lodge 86, which happens to come from the same famous plastic surgeon, I guess. Alaska's Golden Horn Lodge 86. Does that ring a bell?
Well,
You can look at it on your screen right now because I'll do this.
The thing about 1986, of course, is that's my
birthday.
No, that's when I graduated from high school. But also the Golden Horn Lodge is in Dillingham.
Have you been?
No, but I know it because everybody in Alaska is like super fascinated with hunting lodges, fishing lodges, and Dillingham is like a village that's a town. It's not a village. It's a town. Mm. But it's sort of...
it's a town.
It's by Sitka. You know, it's like... it's a place you fly in and hang out and probably drink and hit each other with leather fobs and hunt and fish.
It's unclear what that pin would be.
It's like a seaplane destination. So this is to say, I went there... This was the classic era of enameled pins. Like, I have boxes and boxes of enameled pins from the 80s. And I think those people who this episode will have aired already. No, this episode will not have aired before our live show at the town hall.
No, it will. It will. This is a late October show.
Yeah, so airing before the town hall show.
Yes.
And so you still could hear this show and get to the town hall. And I think we'll have enameled pins for
I think some. We're going to have pins. It's going to be exciting. There's going to be merch. There's going to be other cool stuff in the lobby. I think at this point, we're pretty much sure there's going to be food and there's going to be music.
A little bit of music.
A little bit of music, a little bit of food.
Entertainment, some dancing.
Is there dancing?
There's dancing. There's girls, but there aren't dancing girls.
We were not able to get the license. Are you done? Should we wrap this up?
I think I'm well done.
Because this show was supposed to be short, but it wasn't.
Not short.
It was the opposite of short.
People don't want short. Except in the case of Billy Joel.
That's right. Christie Brinkley apparently wants short if he would just not drink and be nicer. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. We hope the spirit of Australia, too, eventually hits the water and we don't have to ding the bell for Ken Warby's son. But if the worst comes soon, you know the rest. This recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.